Yeah, I do believe we're recording.
Excellent. Hello, this is Simon Mercep, and this is also Crave. It's a podcast dedicated to film, music, television, theatre, just about anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and me lately.
And we'll start with some music. We'll talk about a singer who captured headlines around the world, not for her music, but for a horrific act that followed one of her concerts. So very shortly we'll hear about Ariana Grande's most recent concert, which was right here in Auckland.
And also, yet another one of those odd couple action comedy movies, the buddy movies they're called, aren't they? The one's just arrived here. This time, it's Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson chewing up the scenery in The Hitman's Bodyguard.
Oh, don't they chew it royally, yes. And do you think they could possibly have come up with a more on-the-nose title? I mean, it's a bit ponderous, isn't it? It doesn't exactly fly, does it?
No, it doesn't. Mind you, someone who does is Tom, doesn't he?
Oh, I see what you did there. Very good. Yes, Tom Cruise. Once again in the pilot's seat, as he seems to seem very comfortable cinematically. And he's flying quite highly in his latest film, American Made, which, let's face it, it's an airborne Tom Cruise vehicle this time, isn't it?
It is, but you know what, Steve? I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but I actually thought it was quite good. I'm just whispering that.
Yeah, don't worry, no one's listening.
So anyway,
let's move on from Tom Cruise for a moment. Let's start with the American singer Ariana Grande. Now, Simon, she probably wouldn't be particularly prominent on your radar, I'm sure, had it not been for the atrocity back in Manchester earlier in this year, back in May of this year.
Actually, Steve, that's absolutely right. I actually wasn't familiar with her or her music, but yes, that bombing right at the end of her show in Manchester with more than 20 people killed, it really made everyone sit up and take notice all around the world, didn't it?
It did, rather sadly, yes.
Yeah, absolutely true, Steve. Look, to be honest, I really wasn't familiar with her or her music, but that bombing at the end of that show in Manchester, there were more than 20 people killed. It made headlines everywhere, made everyone sit up and pay attention to her. And I guess it wasn't the sort of limelight any artist particularly wants. So you might recall, though, I think she took part, didn't she, in that big charity concert about a week or so later in Manchester, and that seemed to get her on side of the community. And now, here we are, a few months later, she's here. She's been in Auckland. She was there. We're talking to you on Sunday morning. She was there last night at the Spark Arena in Auckland on a Saturday night. And our special music correspondent, Debbie, was there for Crave. Debbie, hello. Hi. Welcome.
Hi, Simon. Thank you.
Look, first of all, just before we get on to the music, Debbie, I saw some reports, given that what happened in Manchester, there's been that there might have been some security concerns all through her tour, including here. For you going along to the show, did you have any sense that there was a tighter security than you would normally expect?
Yeah, absolutely. We were alerted ahead of time to not bring any kind of bags at all, and that our personal belongings would go in a very small plastic bag, kind of like what you do in the airlines when you're headed to America.
Okay, so this was something you had to do before you even got into the arena. They were checking for those bags.
Actually, they were handing out the bags, and they let us know they would be. So we didn't bring bags. We just carried a minimal amount of personal items. And when we got there, they were handing out the bags. Spark is actually, they've done well to take over the arena. I have to be honest. I really like their presence there. They were handing out umbrellas because the weather was not good. There was rain on and off. So they were handing out brightly colored Spark logo emblazoned umbrellas, which was great. Yes. So we did get one right away and kept us dry. So that was good. Yep. They also had an area where they had music playing and not too loud, which was great. It was just the right volume for people to really enjoy while they were in line. And they were handing out some little bags of candies and things like that. So that was great. I was impressed.
Yeah. And once you got inside the arena, did it feel like any other arena for any other show, or was there still even there a sense of extra security?
Well, we did get wanded as we walked in. Each person had to put their arms out. They got wanded, turned around, wanded again, and then our tickets were checked and off we went into the arena. Once we arrived in the arena, all of that was done.
Cool. All right. We better talk about some music then.
Yes, absolutely.
well, Yeah, so please, what did you make of the show?
Well, I'll start off by saying that I'm not a fan of Ariana Grande, but or of her music, I should say. I like her music. I've listened to it, but I don't know a lot of the songs. I don't know a lot of the words. So, you know, it was I went to the concert because, first of all, I wanted to review the concert. She's has an amazing stage presence, or so I've had heard. I'm also really impressed with her as a person because of the way she handled Manchester. So I was really excited to see her, and I love the show. So I was really glad I went. It was great. And we waited in line from about 4:30. So the umbrellas were really, really good. Thank you, Spark. And we got a very great position. We were about three deep from the stage. So got to see her very up close and personal. I was impressed with her. She's she's absolutely gorgeous. I thought she was quite on form. She didn't look like she was in any way fatigued from a long tour. She seemed to have it all going on, and she's got an impressive voice. So that was great.
Okay. And just, Debbie, on the show itself, because, again, and this is pleading ignorance on my part, I have this image of a young American pop singer doing pop. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. She's definitely a pop singer, definitely doing pop, and she is American. So yeah, I think you're right on.
What about, did she, like many artists do these days, have a lot of backing tracks, or were there actual musicians on stage with her?
There were musicians on stage. She had the usual dancers, you know, that a lot of these pop stars have. They were brilliant, of course. There were some backing vocals, because I know Nicki Minaj did some backing vocals, but she didn't have a physical presence there. But the music was good. The only regret I had really about the show was that the sound mixing was not good. Far too much bass. I don't know why, but that took away from the music a little bit, and it made it a little bit harder to concentrate on the vocals, which I think is what I personally was there for. I'm sure a lot of people.
Yeah, know. Absolutely. That is a bit. Yeah, that is disappointing. Did you get a sense from the people around you that they shared your view on that?
Yes, I did, actually. There was a few people that we kind of looked at each other during some of the really heavy bass sections, and we're kind of looking at it going, wow, is this really bad? And yeah, I actually spoke to a woman in front of me who agreed. She's like, wow, what's up?
You know? Okay. So, yeah, what's up? Hey, so having said that, I'm guessing that most of the audience were a younger audience. And how do you think she went down with them?
Yes, I would say that the audience was predominantly young women, and they loved her, of course. So I'm sure they're all really big fans. They were dancing, knew all the words, did the usual sort of videoing themselves singing the words, which I always think is quite fun. But yeah.
So I, the other thing I'm really curious about is whether several months on from Manchester, Debbie, Ariana Grande did in any way reference what happened in Manchester in her show.
Yes, she did. Towards the end of the show, up on the large screen, she had, I guess, which is what has become sort of her icon for Manchester, which is a ribbon. The sort of ribbon you'd see for breast cancer or prostate cancer, that sort of ribbon with the bunny ears on top, which I guess is her reference to Manchester, which I hadn't known, but I was told. And she sang Over the Rainbow, beautifully sung. And it was very powerful. And that is her reference to Manchester.
And do you think most of the audience understood that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Again, mostly young women who were big fans. So, yeah.
This is something, again, I can't tell you some of the names of some of her big pop songs, but having been to her show and got a sense of who she is as a person, would you see yourself buying an album of hers and sitting down to listening to it at some stage?
Quite possibly. I hadn't really thought that that would be something that I would do before I went to the concert, but now that I've seen her, I think, I might just do that. Or find someone I know who might have her album. And the other thing I wanted to mention about the concert, which I thought was significant, well, there's two things about her concert that I thought was significant, was that she brought a lot of her props with her. There were balloons, there was confetti. At one point, there was these sort of looked like small American dollar bill confettis, which had her, it wasn't her picture. No, maybe it was. Anyway, it was, you know, specific to her. And those were really fun. The young women at the concert absolutely went crazy over those. A lot of the stage props looked like they were very specific to her show. She had like a boxing I can't remember what it's called, like a big boxing bag. And mm-hmm. she had some kind of a
punching bag, that sort of thing.
Punching bag. Yeah, yeah. And she had some kind of other gym equipment, which went along with a particular song, which I don't remember the name of. I apologize. Okay. And so she had a lot of props, a lot of, you know, fun things going on. The lighting was amazing. I thought that was really good, because sometimes when I've seen acts like that, pop star acts in other countries, they have a lot more of their props with them, I think, because they're, you know, not having to fly in. Whereas down under, a lot of times some of the artists don't bring a lot of their props. So I was impressed with her for bringing a lot of her props with her. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is that the opening act, which we were never told the name of, was really unnecessary. It was an it was an EDM duo. And if someone told me that they had just grabbed these guys out of the parking lot, I would believe them. It was really not good. It was totally unnecessary. And I think that it was a very cheap thing on the promoter's part to put them in for this. They could have just done away with it. I'm used to seeing opening acts that I imagine that I may one day see as starring acts. And I've you know, that's happened in other shows that I've been to. So this was quite disappointing.
Mm. Maybe they were there just to make her look all the better.
Maybe. I don't okay. know. A bit of an apologist there, Simon, but that's okay.
Hey, Debbie, thank you so much for going along and talking to us about Ariana Grande.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you, Simon.
Now, another entry in that well-honed and, in fact, grossly overused movie trope, the buddy action comedy. We've seen plenty, haven't we, over the years? So many that you have to wonder, where's the new angle? What's going to be fresh?
Yeah, I don't know is the answer. But someone somewhere thinks that they're still worth churning out these sorts of movies. Did I say something in English then? I think I did. Movies. Because I guess, Steve, they do make decent money, or at least some of them do. And there's been so many of them. The first one I thought of was movies like, you know, Mel Gibson and Danny Glover and the Lethal Weapon movies. They had about, I don't know how many million of those they had.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about the Rush Hour movies with the unlikely pairing of Jackie Chan and Chris Rock.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes it's sci-fi. You know, you get Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith and those Men in Black sort of comedy movies.
Yeah, and I think possibly the touchstone for The Hitman's Bodyguard. You know, it is a clunky title, isn't it? Oh, I think possibly the touchstone for this. You remember Midnight Run, the Robert De Niro film? Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro. I kind of get the feeling that's where they were going, because it's a buddy movie. It's a road movie. So let's just rehash the plot here of.
Actually, can I just say something to you? Just quickly, because you mentioned Midnight Run. I actually remember a scene from that movie, and I saw that years and years ago. Have I got this right, Steve? Where Robert De Niro's character is trying to unlock a door. He drops the key. He bends down to pick up the key, and someone shoots a bullet through the keyhole. Okay. For some reason, that moment stuck in my mind. That's probably decades ago.
but it was a bloody good film, and it does have moments that stick with you.
Yes, I know. Anyway. look, I think you're right, Steve. There's these things that you kind of know what to expect, don't you? And really, at the end of it, it's not so much the plot or even the action. These things work or they don't work, whether the two leads get on. There's some sort of chemistry. I actually thought in this one, not too bad. But I'll try and do a very, very quick summary of the plot, just for the sake of being professional, if that's the right word to use. So we've got Ryan Reynolds. He's a professional bodyguard. His career crashes and burns when someone he's protecting is assassinated. And he thinks his Interpol agent wife, Amelia, who's played by Elodie Young, who, by the way, was in that Defenders Netflix series we were talking about last week, that she somehow is responsible for this. And what we find out is later, some years later, he gets a chance to resurrect his career and his marriage to Amelia when she is transporting a notorious assassin called Darius Kincaid to The Hague in the Netherlands to take the stand, to be a good guy and be a witness against the the evil leader of Belarus, who's played, by Gary Oldman. So what happens here is that Oldman's henchmen attack Emilia's convoy. She has to have someone else take Darius to The Hague. Who else should it be but Ryan, of course, Ryan Reynolds. So he is enlisted to take Darius, and who is Darius but Samuel L. Jackson. So Darius and Samuel L. Jackson and Ryan Reynolds team up to get to The Hague so that he can say what a terrible chap Gary Oldman is. That's about as succinct as I can make it, and I don't think I did a very good job. But basically, it's just the way to get the two actors, Reynolds and Jackson, together to spar their way through the movie. And the question is, Mr. McCabe, did you think you were entertained by any of this?
Well, I was entertained by the film.
Yes.
You've got serious star quality there, haven't you? I mean, just in Reynolds and in Jackson together. Oldman chews up scenery like scenery has never been chewed before. He gets to do a dodgy Eastern European accent, which is always good value. But obviously the key dynamic is Reynolds and Jackson, and it's rubbish. Either one of them individually is brilliant. I mean, they're both fantastic actors. And Samuel Jackson's doing a slightly toned-down version of his standard Samuel Jackson shtick. Ryan Reynolds is basically doing off-duty Deadpool.
Yeah.
And either one of them would have been absolutely fine. They didn't need to be together in this film. I don't think that putting them together created a whole that was in any way greater than the sum of the parts. They seem to be acting past each other half the time, which is not to say there wasn't an awful lot of really fun lines, well delivered, lots of wit, lots of charm in the script, and the most absurdly protracted chases and explosions and gunfights and squelchy, splatty, bangy bits.
Yes.
But...
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, on the latter point, yes, absolutely. Yet again, one of those movies where it seems utterly impossible that the bad guys could be firing so many bullets at the good guys and not one bullet ever hits them, you know, that type of scenario that we see all the time.
And yet the good guys point a gun in the vague general direction and get them between the eyes every time. It's marvellous.
It's amazing, isn't it? Oh, they're so talented. I laughed out loud quite a bit, actually, here and there. I don't entirely agree with you about the two of them, only from the point of view that, as you say, Jackson is the well, kind of being just Samuel L. Jackson, and he did some Samuel L. Jackson very well. He's very good at being Samuel L. Jackson.
He's been doing it for a long time, hasn't he?
Yes.
Do you even pick up on the fact that the Reynolds character complains that Jackson's character has now overdone a certain particular Jackson patented swear word?
Ah, yeah, this is the mother. Yes.
The melon farmer, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he's Jackson's character has got his Jackson laugh.
Yes.
Down to a T. He dispenses his street wisdom here, there, and everywhere, mainly directed at Ryan Reynolds. There are some genuinely funny scenes. Somehow, in the course of his career as an assassin, Samuel L. Jackson's character has learned how to sing in Italian, and that was quite a nice, funny little scene at one point.
Was it just me? We might as well mention that there's a scene involving a load of nuns. And they were basically the Minions, weren't they?
I guess they were. Yeah, true.
But
true.
They were cute. They were adorable, as nuns go.
Yeah, I guess the thing about them was that although Ryan Reynolds' character is a bit of an action hero, his personality is rather almost wimpish at times. And Jackson is in your face, just everything that he is. So they're very contrasting in that sense, and that these movies have to work with the two characters butting heads and the differences in their personality providing hopefully the comic frisson. I think I hear what you're saying about them acting past each other. A lot of the lines that Samuel L. Jackson delivers, he could have just been delivering them to the camera, but he didn't necessarily have to be saying them
at all.
But the ridiculousness of the stunts and everything else in the end became quite funny, I thought. And maybe whether that was intentional or not, I'm not quite sure. I could see this doing reasonably well just because the two very well-known actors doing well. Oh, we mentioned Gary Oldman. We should also mention Salma Hayek, who plays Samuel L. Jackson's wife, and she chews up the scenery just as much as Gary Oldman does.
Oh, she was having the time of her life. She had an enormous fun making this film.
Yeah, I know. So you'd go to see it just to see these people doing their stuff, really, and not take it. But please don't take it seriously. Of course, it's just a bit of a diversion. But
well, listen. Here's what I will say: if they're not going to take the geography of my home country seriously,
yes,
then we should take the film seriously. I just want to mention it starts off that for reasons that are never well established, Kincaid is in an Interpol holding house in Manchester.
That's right, yep.
Now, I wasn't aware there was one, but who knows? I mean, obviously, I'm not privy to everything that Interpol do, but in all the shots, including the aerial shots of the city I grew up in, I didn't see anything of the Manchester I knew. And then for some reason, to get him down to The Hague in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, for some reason, they drove through the centre of Coventry for reasons that were never particularly explained. Does not seem like an even remotely effective way of getting there. Apparently, they set it in Coventry and filmed it in Sofia in Bulgaria.
Right.
it is absolutely bizarre, these ridiculous choices of setting that seem so utterly arbitrary and random. And lead to, I mean, like I say, why on earth, when you're transporting such a high value and such a in-demand prisoner, why would you transport him straight through the centre of a city? And why would you go to Coventry anyway?
I don't know.
We shall move on from that. We shall move on from that because I'm frustrated with the bizarreness of the whole thing.
It is silly and it is bizarre. Not much makes a lot of sense. There are some ridiculous coincidences. Just quickly, Steve, the one that absolutely stuck in my mind as soon as it happened was you talked about those ludicrous chase scenes. At one point, the pair separate.
Yes.
And Ryan Reynolds is running through cafes and kitchens and having a big fight. He just rushes outside just as Samuel L. Jackson drives by. And I thought, oh, yeah, sure. Yes, of course. Samuel L. Jackson knew exactly where he was. Anyway.
You reach the point where you just shrug your shoulders and say, I'm just going with this. Because the film generates, I think, enough goodwill.
Yes, it does do that. And I think, it does. And that's because of the two leads. They are guys, it's hard not to like them for all the silliness of the plot. So the question is, would you tell someone to go spend a bit of money and sit down and watch this, Steve?
I think if there's nothing else playing, this would make a perfectly pleasant evening out at the cinema. It's not going to win any awards. It's not even, I mean, here's what I will say about it. Right, I got home after seeing this film. And by the time I sat on the sofa, I'd almost actually forgotten that I'd seen it.
This is the popcorn candy, a candy floss movie. How about that?
There you go. Yeah. So, I mean, it is so. It while they obviously spent like millions upon millions upon millions making this, it is entertaining. It is frothy. It is fun. And yeah, buy a ticket and go and see it. But don't even expect it to stick with you by the time you've got home.
Fair enough. I can't disagree.
Quite right too. Now, Simon, we spent a bit of time lampooning the efforts of Tom Cruise of late. I mean, let's face it, The Mummy.
Yes, I thought that was quite awful, actually, Steve.
I know. We were genuinely hoping we'd never have to discuss that film again, weren't we, really?
No, but the thing is, that film, I couldn't believe it, but it actually made a reasonable amount of money. But it did get me thinking, you know, about the acting credentials or not of Tom Cruise. I mean, we both talked about how so much of the time it seems that really he's just playing himself. Wondered.
We just said that about Samuel L. Jackson, and I was thinking, we're accusing Jackson of doing that, but I mean, he's got range. In comparison, he's got dimension and depth.
Yes. Well, here's a question for you. Have you seen many Cruise movies you've actually genuinely liked?
Oh, can I get back to you on that one?
Well, there's only one that that's mean, isn't it? Oh, that's so cruel. But there's one that does immediately spring to my mind, which I quite like because I do like sci-fi. And he did something called Minority Report.
Yes.
Oh, quite a few years ago now. It had some other decent actors in it. And I quite like that. But, Steve, you know, I was just doing a bit of prep for our chat today. And just reading a bit of Tom Cruise's history, I'd sort of forgotten that he's actually won 2 Golden Globes for Best Actor. One way back in 1989 for Born on the 4th of July.
Yes.
And then in the mid-90s for Jerry Maguire. And in both those films, he was Oscar nominated for both. So somewhere, somehow, you know, there's some some people see some acting talent in this guy.
Well, I've long suspected, to be fair. I mean, look at the film. I suddenly can't remember the name, the title of it. Jack Nicholson film with...
A few men.
Yeah, a few good men.
Something like that. A few good men. A few angry men. That's 12 angry men.
Exactly. And it's got you know, that famous court scene where Jack Nicholson screams about not handling the truth. And it occurs to me that that for the most part, Tom Cruise has made a career out of choosing his scripts very, very well.
Yeah, yeah. Which brings us, speaking of his career, to the latest entry in it. And this is something that's only just been released just a few days ago. I actually thought, in the context of his work, that this was some of his better work. And this is a film called American Made. There's quite a story to what it's all about. What did you reckon about this, Steve?
Oh, it's fun, isn't it? And I think that's probably all it really is. It's a supposedly based, and let's face it, we've both read up a little bit about the true story. It's very, very, very liberally and loosely based on the story of an American pilot who started flying, according to the film at least, at the behest of the CIA, importing drugs from... down south in South America, exporting weapons and basically getting really, really deeply embroiled in a situation that he couldn't really quite contain any longer.
Yeah.
And so you've got Tom Cruise playing a pilot, which he's obviously enjoyed doing an awful lot in the past. You've got now...
So he's called... The pilot he plays is a real character. This is a real bloke called Barry Seal. And... you're right. So in the film, the way the film tells it, Steve, it's the CIA who approaches Barry Seal first with an offer to sort of forget about his day job, if you will. And this is at the time of Iran-Contra and Nicaragua and Noriega and all that sort of carry on, and the Americans being concerned about communism just in their backyard in Central America. And so he has to sort of bring the Contras up to his little was it not Nebraska, Arkansas, and get them all trained up. So he seems to be, according to the film, doing the government's work in a very sneaky way and earning lots of money. But as you say, he gets embroiled with the Medellin drug cartel and ends up kind of playing both sides, doesn't he? He's playing one off against the other.
That's kind of the way it's presented. I mean, apparently the reality is very, very murkier than that. But that's the way it's presented. That he starts off doing sort of petty smuggling of cigars, is it Cuban cigars out of Canada or something like that? I forget the exact details. But he's approached by I believe we're pronouncing this Donal Gleason, who plays quite brilliantly with almost reptilian sliminess, a CIA agent called Schaefer, who approaches him and says, "So this is what you do. You're a pilot. And you're a small-time smuggler as well. Well, how about being a smuggler for us?" And as you say, he ends up way in above his head.
Yeah, yeah. And earning literally bucket loads of cash. He doesn't know what to do with it. Yeah.
Yes. And so he ends up with his wife, Lucy, played quite wonderfully by Sarah Wright, suddenly wondering how the hell they're going to manage all these mountains of cash. Yeah. And so her brother... ends up dropping them in it from a great height.
Yes, yes, because he's a none too bright and just can't resist all that cash and getting caught out with it. That's right. And I just thought, Steve, one thing I liked about that, it had a certain quirkiness and oddball aspect to the way the story was told.
Yes, it did.
And it got quite comedic sort of a way. But also they interspersed it with quite a bit of actual news footage of the time. And there was a bit of jumping around the timelines, which is quite cleverly done. So it wasn't until afterwards when I went back and did a bit of reading that I realized how much they changed the story. But for most of the time when you're in the film watching it, you feel as if you're watching a story that's broadly an accurate story of what went on. So it did succeed in dragging me through that, and I was interested to know what happened to the guy. But I just want to ask you about Cruise's performance, because I guess that's an important part of it. I mean, he is Tom Cruise. He's always Tom Cruise. But I thought he kind of dialed it back a bit. And because he's playing a character who's not Lily White and a hero in the traditional sense of the word, a guy who's got his moral compass is somewhat askew, that he kind of did quite well with that for him. Add that qualification.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because you know it's basically Tom Cruise's smile topped by a pair of aviator shades, and that's basically the role that he thinks he was born to play. And he's been playing it since Top Gun, and you can tell that's where he feels most at home. And you can tell he was having a great time doing it. And you're right, he did have to dial it back, because he wasn't quite as one-dimensionally the good guy. He was definitely...
No, not at all.
He definitely knew he was compromised. Now, the film tries to depict it as he has been compromised by others.
Yes.
The reality was more that he was a very failed individual personally. But the way that the film presents Barry Seal is, yeah, he's a bit of a mess of a man, really, because he allows himself to get bogged down in so many things that he can't handle. But he does, I think Tom Cruise does find a certain amount of warmth in the character, does find charm. Like I said, he's got that 1,000-watt smile.
You know,
teeth that glow in the dark.
We mentioned the flying. You're a pilot. I really enjoyed some of the aerial shots in the film.
Yes.
It just looked good. And I really enjoyed, as a wonderful scene early-ish on the film, where he starts his career as a Medellin drug cartel runner for them, and he has to get his plane off a very short runway, and it's quite a dramatic scene crashing through treetops. I thought that was very well done.
Well, unfortunately, from a pilot's point of view, that was probably the least realistic scene
in the entire
film. It was, however, very tense and very, very well played.
but
I'm thinking, seriously, mate, if I'd flown like that on my private pilot check ride, I still wouldn't have my wings. But you don't fuss. The film had enough fun to it that I didn't find myself second guessing and correcting all the flying stuff in it. I just sat back and enjoyed it. And I think that's the real test of a film like that.
Yes, and the guy who directed it, Doug Lehman, I'm not quite sure you say his name, he's been around for a while. He directed the first of the Jason Bourne trilogies way back. So he's got a few credentials in this sort of area, and I think he's also directed Cruise in an earlier film too. So the cast is good, and as I say, I think it's quite good to see him not playing just an out and out hero, but a character. I'm talking about Tom Cruise, character who has got some questionable aspects to his character, and it's good that he was willing to take that on. And you're right, he's still the flashing teeth and everything else, but it just made it gave it a little bit more depth than you might otherwise get. So, if you're going to ask me, which I will,
would you? in fact, I'll ask right now. Would you recommend spending your hard-earned drug-running cash on this?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think I would. I think I would. I think it's got a good combination of some drama, some thrills, some humour. You feel as if you're seeing a story that probably took place in real life, although it may not be. You may learn later that that's not the case. And it's well worth it. It's got a lot more going for it. I think I'll remember this film more than I'll remember The Hitman's Bodyguard.
I'll definitely go with that one. Yes, that's a very reasonable assessment.
Yes, good. Now, Steve, just before we sort of bring our scintillating discussion to a close.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And look, we did talk, or I raised very briefly last time, that I'd seen the first few episodes of this new Netflix series called The Defenders. Did you end up catching any of those?
No, I didn't. I've been busy jetting around the world, Simon. I've just not had chance for TV. Sorry, mate. Very, very,
no.
Very, very slack of me.
No. Well, I think that's actually quite good, because I'm having now... watch the rest of it. My advice to you, sir, is not to bother.
Are you saying I've dodged a bullet here?
Yeah. I think it's one of those ones where if you're familiar with the source material, in this case it's Marvel comic books, if you're familiar with the material and you like the characters involved, you will get something out of it, I think. But if you're not familiar, I don't think so. I can't imagine you... A man of your great taste and discernment, Steve, would get a lot out of this.
You do me favours.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyhow, I last time I was trying to say, look, they did. This was an attempt to tell the superhero story in a grittier, noirish sort of a way, and they do that, and they've employed a good actor like Sigourney Weaver to beef it up. But it does have, at the end of it, I thought, a bit of a B grade quality about it. A good B grade, but still a B grade. And maybe that's an inevitable feeling when you compare this Marvel product with all the, you know, the huge money spent on the movies, which obviously look like, I was going to say $1 billion probably. So don't bother unless you really, really want to. I would say just let it go.
I appreciate the advice. I really do. Thank you for that.
That's quite all right.
Now, before we do finish, we do have a couple of things to look forward to.
Yes.
We have got, coming up very shortly,
yes,
one of the most awaited films of the year, or of several years. On Wednesday is going to be the press screening for a future short forthcoming release of the remake of Stephen King's classic It.
Ah. Yeah, we were just talking about Stephen King the other week, weren't we? And all the various cinematic interpretations of his work. We didn't think the filmmakers did a good job with The Dark Tower.
No, and that's been roundly trounced by critics the world over.
Yeah, let's hope that It does better.
On the one hand, it couldn't do a whole lot worse by all accounts. On the other hand, it's looking like it's going to be really, really terrifying. I'm not looking forward to walking back to my car in the dark after seeing that one. That one's going to be scary. There's also Blade Runner is going to be coming very shortly. That's in the next month or so. It's going to be interesting. Another remake.
Well, it's a remake, but it's actually a positioning of the story in the future. I think it is, Steve. So it's called Blade Runner, 2049 or something. So it's taking the Harrison Ford character from Ridley Scott's first film, and that character reappears as an older man. So I think it's a different story. It's the same setting, but a different story further in the future.
Oh, okay, my apologies.
Yeah, so I think that there'll be particularly amongst the sci-fi community, huge interest in this. I think that you often read that Blade Runner is regarded as one of the most visually influential films of recent decades, especially in that sort of fantasy sci-fi sort of area.
Yes.
So I think there'll be a lot of interest in that. I'll be certainly seeing that one.
Yes. Then one show that's generated a lot of interest in the music front is Katy Perry.
Ah, okay.
Now, I have to read you what the press release says, because, I mean, I think we can use the word overblown. Now, this is for August of next year. So this was announced like virtually 12 months in advance. Yeah. It says, "Witness the tour is an imaginative trip from outer space to inner space, from the planets to the bottom of our oceans, and a musical journey through Katy Perry's biggest milestones and mega hits right up to her latest album." Now, how could you possibly not be utterly, utterly hooked by that?
Do I have to answer that?
I'll let you just ponder the significance yes. and the enormity of what I just read. And yes, I know what the word enormity means. So she sold out already the 20th of August at Spark Arena. She's announced a second date for the 21st. I'm not sure if there's tickets left, but let's just mention it anyway, just in case, because that sounds seriously. What's the word we're looking for here? What's a good word for that?
Well, it's. For some people, it'll be an epic experience, won't it? I suspect.
I'm sure it will.
Sounds
quite marvellous. That's next year. I mean, we're planning ahead enormously. Also coming to town very shortly is going to be Roger Waters.
Oh.
Late of Pink Floyd.
Yes, absolutely.
But obviously not Pink Floyd with him, for, you know, fairly obvious reasons these days. But he's going to be here touring some new material, and then an awful lot of apparently the classic Pink Floyd stuff. He's going to be playing stuff from Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here, and of course The Wall. So that's going to be really entertaining. And he's doing Spark Arena in Auckland on Wednesday the 24th of January, and Forsyth Barr Stadium in Dunedin on Tuesday the 30th of January. So that's going to be quite impressive.
Yes,
we've got. Do you remember the name James Blunt?
I do.
The man who's
not with any great affection necessarily, but I do remember his name.
Fair enough. Well,
I shouldn't have said that.
You know what? Not everyone was a fan. In fact, a lot of people were very snarky about him. But, you know, he's released, I think it's his fifth album just recently.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, he's been slogging away for a long time. And so I take it you won't be in the queue for his show on the 6th of March at Spark Arena then?
I think I probably won't, but I think many people would.
I think they will, and possibly down in Christchurch. He's also playing the Horncastle Arena on Thursday, the 8th of March as well. So I have a feeling he'll probably do well on that. He's a niche market.
I'm just trying to quickly think of that the big hits that he had first up, which was a massive hit.
You're Beautiful.
You're Beautiful, of course. That's the one.
Yeah, it was basically a great big sugar cube coated in saccharin.
Yes.
But
People
liked it. And the other really big name that's announced for this in the last week is Robbie Williams.
Ah. God, is he still going? Gosh.
You can't keep a good man down, can you?
No. Here you are.
Now, he's doing a tour he's calling the Heavy Entertainment Show.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where they're getting these titles from. But he's going to be in Auckland on Wednesday the 14th at the Spark Arena, 14th of February, that is. And Dunedin is also doing Forsyth Bar Stadium, and that's going to be Saturday the 17th of February. And we all remember the almost stage-managed shenanigans that happened last time he was here.
I don't. Please remind me, Mr. McKay.
You don't remember. A somewhat well-known critic who writes for Stuff here in New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
Which led to lots of
criticism
headlines.
Written ahead of time.
That's how it came across, in my opinion. Obviously, I can't know that for certain, but it certainly
felt like it was
a particularly barbed. And I have to say, I was at Robbie Williams' last concert in Auckland. He played about 2 or 3 days after that little kerfuffle. And I didn't think the review was at all fair. I thought he put on a perfectly fine show. He's not my absolute favourite artist, but he puts on a very good performance. His music is adequate. He's got a few decent songs, and he's got a very, very strong stage presence.
Yes, yes. Well, he knows the stage very well, and he knows how to play to an audience, I'm sure.
Well, that's the one. So given that in November we've got the rest of Take That are going to be here. I don't think they'll coincide on stage at any time soon, but between November and February, you will actually be able to see the entire of Take That in Auckland.
Can't wait.
If you are so inclined and moved to do so.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My plate is full.
Absolutely. So that's what's coming up in the near future.
Lovely. In the meantime, we'd be very keen to hear from you. We do get lots of interesting comments on Facebook and likes on Facebook, which we really appreciate. So thank you for that. Also, if you want to get in touch with us on Crave, you can email us. The email address is podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
You can. So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
He is, and that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Well, that went about as well as could be expected.
Yes. Hey, look, just that's true. Well, hey, look, I just want to ask you one quick thing before we go. Because you and I spend a lot of time talking about movies and watching movies, and we've done it for a little while now. And I just keep reading in the various news agencies, Steve, that this northern summer, especially in the United States, it's been an absolute disaster for box office attendances. They've just movie after movie has crashed, basically, and not. I think it's the worst so-called boom season in 15 years or something. And I just wondered, do you think from the movies you and I have been seeing that it's just they're a terrible bunch of movies, or is it just something else going on? Any thoughts on that?
I do have a thought on that one, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because if you look most weeks these days, look at your local listing at the cinema.
Yeah.
And look at what's on offer. You've typically got sequels. You've got latest in franchises. You've got, what have we seen recently? You know, the latest version of Spider-Man. There's another Planet of the Apes. There's yet another Marvel film. You know, Wonder Woman was incredibly popular and successful, but it's still part of a larger universe. There is very little that's actually genuinely new coming out. And I think people are just getting sick of it. I think that people are getting bored of seeing the same films over and over again.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think there's that. Maybe there's more and more people are just tuning into the internet offerings, like, you know, on Netflix or whatever else it might be. That might be part of it. But yeah, I think you're probably right. It's something's going on.
Do you want to see Despicable Me 3 tonight, or do you want to see Cars 3?
Take your point.
These are your choices. I think that's got a lot to do with it. Plus, as you say, the overall quality in the cinemas is starting to take a downtick. And at the same time, when you think that the studio should be upping their games to compete against the high quality that we're getting from Netflix and HBO and the like, they're simply not equal to the challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mind you, I tell you, I suppose what seems to happen is that movie makers think they need to fall back on a formula that's worked in the past, but they're not necessarily taking into account audience fatigue, which is the point you're making, I guess.
I think, I hadn't thought of it in those words, but yes.
And where it really, it's the need to come up with new ideas and freshly presented ideas, which is what's going to keep people interested and coming back and paying some money to sit down in a movie theater. Anyway, look, it's all interesting stuff. It'll be interesting to see over the next few months what happens, what the trend will be. In the meantime...
In the meantime, let me stop you for a sec, because we need to actually... Yes. We have a couple more announcements. I'll edit these back in.
Oh, yes, please do.
There's a couple more that we need to announce.
Yes.
Because I kind of promised publicists that we would.
Good.
So this will take some fancy editing from me, but let's also mention that